Hi there, folks, and welcome back to NTI's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nikodimam again. Great to have you with us today. Hope things are well in your corner of the world, wherever it may be. Here in Japan, the schools have finally opened, still just for half a day in most places, or at least here in Fukuoka City where we are. But it's good to finally be able to give the kids some running room and socializing. I know our son, at least, was starting to feel the effects of being isolated for so long, with only us and the cats for company, really. And to be perfectly honest, Chikako and I also breathed a big sigh of relief. Having said that, I read that new COVID-19 cases have been on the rise again, not only here in Japan, but in other countries as well. So best not to be too optimistic just yet. We may be up for some more isolation in the months to come. But for now, at least, there's a bit of a respite, and I'll definitely drink to that one. Okay, so we've got another great interview/conversation for you today. Those among you who have been following the podcast for some time might have noticed that whenever I'm asked if there are any books on the topic of buying property here in Japan, I always mention, our own ebook series for starters, which is geared mainly towards foreign investors, but also a book by the name of Landed Japan, which is now in its second revised edition and is a part of a series of books written by a gentleman who goes by the name of Christopher Dillon. He's originally from Canada and now lives in Hong Kong, where, aside from writing, he also runs a successful communication strategy and training company named after him, Dillon Communications. So he's quite the entrepreneur, property purchase enthusiast, public speaker, corporate advisor. But the reason I first got in touch with him and the reason why I've asked him to come and speak with us today is, of course, due to the excellent series of books that he authored. So the Landed books, which cover a variety of countries, they're really a series of guides and reference manuals for anyone interested in purchasing real estate properties in the respective countries about which he's written. And there's also a more general guide called Landed Global, which provides an outline for anyone interested in purchasing property overseas as a rule in any country. Now, Chris is very much the scholar, and you'll probably notice that as you listen to our conversation. His approach to his subject matter is very macro on the one hand, but also very detailed and thorough as he drills down into each and every country and topic that he discusses. And I personally find his academic point of view fascinating, even if, as you'll notice again during our conversation, we sometimes disagree on a particular point or topic. His breadth of knowledge is absolutely impressive, and you could do a lot worse than reading his books before you go ahead and start digging deeper into any particular country that you may be looking at purchasing in. So in our case, we talk mainly about Japan specifically, of course, but also generally about the Asia-Pacific region, and even more broadly about global real estate as a rule. Great conversation, very interesting guy. I hope you enjoy your talk, and I'll see you again on the other side. Chris, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us today. Pleasure to have you with us.
My pleasure, Ziv.
So before we actually start talking shop, it's your first time on the show, and we like to do a bit of a background dive on guests first, if you don't mind, just to get to know you a bit. So could you maybe tell our listeners a little bit of your own personal history? I know you're originally Canadian, but how did you end up in Hong Kong, and how did you end up in the line of work that you're currently in? And while you're at it, how did you get into property in the first place?
Sure. So you're right, I am originally from Canada. I lived in Tokyo from 1989 till 1992, and I've been here in Hong Kong ever since. While I was in Tokyo, I worked for an investor relations company, putting together annual reports and corporate communications materials for large Japanese corporates. And that sort of gave me a background in writing and editing and print production. When I moved to Hong Kong in 1992, I carried on the corporate communications business, and I ended up setting up a business with two partners, which we sold in 1997 to a company that was listed on the London Stock Exchange. And with the proceeds from that sale, just before SARS struck in 2002, I started buying property here in Hong Kong. I bought a floor in an office building in Central. I bought an apartment for my family on the west side of Hong Kong Island. And then the last thing that I bought was an old factory building, because Hong Kong used to be a light manufacturing center. We used to be the world headquarters for making tin lunch boxes and flashlights and thermos flasks and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And of course, all of that business moved to China. So I ended up buying half of a floor in an old factory building and turned that into an audiovisual production facility. With all three of the purchases, I ended up renovating them down to bare cement, bare concrete. And when I got to the end of that process, I realized that there was nothing in English explaining how to buy real estate in Hong Kong. So that was the genesis for the first book, and then it ended up a whole series of books about buying real estate in a variety of different places. One of the keys to all of this is the fact that if you get information about real estate from just about any place, it's all really oriented towards selling things and moving product. And sometimes buying real estate is exactly the right thing to do. I've had some measure of success with it. But other times, buying is probably the worst thing that you can do. Sometimes it just makes more sense to rent. So I really approached the research and the writing of all of these books from the perspective of how do I help the reader become more educated so that they can make smart real estate decisions that they're happy with and their family are happy with and that are financially successful at the end of the day, rather than just buying for the sake of buying.
Right. So have you just researched them, or have you actually gone through the purchase process in each of those countries? I mean, you couldn't have done all of them, right?
No, absolutely. So the books really come in four titles: Landed Hong Kong, Landed Japan, Landed Global, and Landed China. And so Hong Kong and Japan obviously are what's on the tin. Landed Global covers about 110 different countries and territories, and Landed China is obviously, you know, what it says about China. As far as buying, I have bought and sold real estate here in Hong Kong and also in Japan. In China, it's all but impossible for you to buy real estate if you're not Chinese and if you're not a legal resident. So to get around that, what I did was I bought a real estate investment trust that owns commercial real estate in southern China. So I had some skin in the game and actually would learn about, you know, the process and would have an incentive to pay attention. As far as writing the books is concerned, though, the research materials and the information that goes into the books come from a variety of different sources. So when I wrote the first book, that was really based on my firsthand experience doing it. And I would say it was probably about 95% firsthand experience and about 5% research. When I wrote the first edition of Landed Japan back in 2000, though, that was before I had actually bought any real estate in Japan. So I realized that I was going to have to change my approach. And so for all of the books that followed, where I hadn't actually bought real estate, I used a combination of sources. So the first part of that is just reading the newspapers. So if you're talking about Japan, that means reading the Daily Yomiuri, the Japan Times, reading the NHK website, that sort of information, as well as international sources like the Financial Times, the New York Times, you know, business magazines like The Economist, and getting as much background information as I could there. But also, when I was writing these books, before I had firsthand exposure, I did a lot of interviews. And those interviews were with bankers, they were with accountants, they were with developers, they were with real estate agents, they were with people who had actually bought real estate successfully or unsuccessfully in some of these places. So each of the books includes case studies about, you know, how people have actually got on with it. And another source of information in all of this is academic research. I'm a director of the Canadian Academy of Independent Scholars, and through that organization, I have access to a wide variety of academic research. And you might think, like, how would that possibly be applicable to, you know, the sort of books that I'm writing? But it's quite astonishing, the kind of papers that people write, everything from papers about environmental issues like soil and water pollution, that could have something to do with, you know, where you choose to buy a home, to things like the economics of home purchasing and how people decide, for example, how far away they will live from a train station in Japan and where the prices change there. So that's the sort of information that's pulled together for the books. First-hand experience from myself, interviews with industry practitioners, news media from the general media, and then specialist academic research.
Right. And having done all that research, you must have formed a sort of a general or specific picture on the market in each of these countries. Which of them would you say, just generalizing, which of those countries would you prefer to buy if you were buying to live in? Where would you just stick to investment, or vice versa? I mean, from your own experience, which of these countries tick which boxes?
Well, you know, that's a great question. It's, I think, one of the key things that you need to consider is how do the people in that country think about real estate? And let me give you an example on that. Here in Hong Kong, you know, real estate is a place to live and a place to sleep, but it's also a really, really important investment category. And people here are very, very unsentimental about real estate. It's a commodity that's traded, and it's a store of wealth, and people are sort of cold-hearted about it. And if you take a place like Japan, for example, after the war, the Second World War, the Japanese government, or it may actually have been it may have been a previous war, but in any event, the Japanese government introduced very, very tenant-friendly laws, because there was going to be a lot of women who were going to be left behind when their men went to war, and they wanted to protect their interests. And so in a place like Japan, the scales are in a lot of ways tilted towards the tenant, whereas in a place like Hong Kong, real estate is a commodity, buy it and sell it. The first place my wife and I lived in here, to give you an idea, we, back in the early 1990s, we lived in this apartment for 2 years, and we had three owners of that same apartment in the space of 2 years.
Wow.
So, you know, it's horses for courses. Now, in terms of investing versus buying, the whole COVID-19 issue has really, really changed the landscape. Like you and like a lot of people, up until a couple of months ago, I traveled a lot. I thought nothing of going to Thailand for the weekend, or, being Hong Kong, we do a lot of business regionally and internationally. And, you know, you would think of nothing of about hopping on a plane for a couple of days and going to Europe even. And all of a sudden, all of that has changed.
Right.
So if you're thinking about buying real estate across international borders, things have gotten a lot more complicated than they were before. Not only in a lot of cases can you not get a flight, but even if you could get a flight, you couldn't get in. I give you a number to put next to that. In Thailand, the government is only letting 200 people into the country a day. That's 200 Thai nationals or tourists in total. Buying something in a foreign country, if you can't get there to use it, much less to see it, is really, really complicated.
In Japan specifically, we've got a bit of a cultural and language barrier to add on top of that, don't we?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, one of the things that I'm watching, and I think is very, very interesting, is there's a rise in xenophobia, fear and discomfort with foreigners. And that's, you know, there's been, if you've ever tried to rent an apartment as a foreigner in Japan, this is not something new. This is something that's been around for a long time. But the xenophobia is appearing in some really sort of unexpected places. And I'll give you a couple of examples. I have two friends who recently bought a bed and breakfast on the Isle of Mull in Scotland. And the Scottish government right now is, for the last month or so, has been running ads and actively discouraging people from coming to the Isle of Mull and to the outlying islands because they're terrified of them bringing in COVID-19 and having people get sick there and overwhelming the local medical facilities. And we're seeing the same thing in place in cottage country in Canada, north of Toronto, where my wife's family are from. The same thing. You know, it's almost impossible to get there. They're checking license plates on the road to see if you belong there. And you're seeing similar things on Vancouver Island on the west coast of Canada. So where 6 months ago people would welcome tourists, maybe they mumble under their breath about what they do to the traffic conditions, but they would welcome tourists and the tourist dollars. All of a sudden now the tourists are a lot less welcome than they used to be. So, you know, the world is very much changing. Now, if you can get your head around that, I think that before too long, we're going to see some very interesting bargains on recreational property. Mm-hmm. Specifically, places like Hakuba and Niseko in Japan, but also places like Whistler in Vancouver, in Canada, I should say, and also places like Phuket in Thailand. History shows that when times get tough, people tend to dump recreational property before they do anything else because it's discretionary. And if you can't get to these places to use the property, I would see that there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be offloading those, just, you know, because they're perhaps facing a bit of a cash crunch, or they're just tired of paying for the maintenance and insurance on a place that they can't use. So I think that there's going to be an opportunity there. And the other opportunity that I can really see coming through in all of this is places that were purchased for use in like Airbnb rentals.
Yeah.
And I'll give you another example from Canada. There's a building in Toronto that's got about 1,300 units in it, an apartment building. And over 200 of those units are now for sale because they had all been rented out on an Airbnb basis. And of course, there is no Airbnb traffic at the moment. So these are people who are, you know, having to pay the mortgage out of their pocket and have got nothing to offset it in terms of income. So I think you're going to see some opportunities there as well.
Well, we're definitely seeing it here in Japan. Condo units have already been clamped down on regardless of the COVID-19 about a year or so ago, a year and a half now, but people that have guest houses or big old traditional homes that they were leasing out short term, which they could still do, they've just lost their bookings a year or so ahead. And they're, especially the ones with a mortgage on their shoulders, are very, very motivated to sell at the moment.
I'll bet they are.
Yeah.
And we're actually, even in the local newspaper here in Hong Kong, there was the story yesterday about shops in Osaka and Tokyo being sold for 30% discounts if you're interested in buying retail space.
Yeah. And okay, so back to Japan, which is basically our focus here on the podcast. How does it compare to other Asian markets on all of these fronts that you discussed? I mean, your book touches on a lot of the stuff that we've already spoken here on the show many times. So natural disasters and depreciation, the abandoned homes and the deaths with the aging population and so forth. But there's also a lot of stuff there that even I, you know, being someone who lives and breathes this sector on a daily basis, I didn't know much about. So stuff like the buraku you mentioned, which are Japan's historical, yeah, the social menial labor outcasts, and they've got their own little wards that are obviously treated differently, at least by Japanese buyers and sellers.
Yes.
Any other sort of things that you think first-time foreign property buyers should be aware of?
Well, you know, it really depends. I mean, if you are, and when I say it depends on how much you know. I mean, if you're like a lot of the friends that I have and had in Japan who are foreigners who've lived there for a while, you've absorbed a lot of the cultural and sort of background information just by, you know, living and breathing there. But if you're new to Japan, I really strongly recommend that you immerse yourself in, you know, read the newspaper every day, improve the quality of your spoken Japanese so that you can pick up on the cultural cues and really understand what's going on around you. The more you learn and the more you know about the society that you're buying in, the stronger your position is going to be. We have a tradition here in Hong Kong of real estate developers will show up and they'll rent a function room at one of the high-end hotels in central Hong Kong, and they'll sell homes to people who in countries where the buyer has never been to. And this has always been a source of total amazement to me, that people would buy in a place that they hadn't visited, didn't know anything about, and basically just buying blind. So the more you know, the stronger the position that you're going to be in. There's a lot of things that I really like about Japan. Like, for example, as a foreigner, you face almost no restrictions on buying land in Japan. I mean, there are some things in terms of watersheds in Hokkaido and facilities, land near military facilities. But in general, it's very, very easy, and there are very few restrictions on foreigners buying land. And you compare that with, say, Thailand, the Philippines, and Indonesia, where it's all but impossible for foreigners to buy land. The same goes for Hong Kong and China. All of the land in Hong Kong, except what's underneath St. John's Cathedral in Central, is owned by the government, and you don't own it. You just have it on a long-term lease, anywhere from 50 years to, in the case of my apartment here in Hong Kong, it's on a 999-year lease, which is virtually owning. Same thing with China. The state owns all of the land, so you can't own it. So that gives Japan actually quite a big advantage that way. And another big advantage that Japan has is the fact that as a foreigner, you are not treated differently from a tax perspective. So if you take a place like Singapore, if you're a citizen, you pay one rate of tax when you buy. If you are a permanent resident, you pay a different rate of tax. And if you're a non-resident, you pay an even higher rate of tax, whereas Japan is blind to that. So as a foreigner coming in to buy, I find that to be very, very reassuring.
Yeah. And obviously, I mean, if you're buying for your own use, a holiday home, like you're saying, in a country that you've never been to or haven't been to frequently enough to understand, that's obviously a concern. But let's say you're buying as an investor and you're looking at a foreign country. Obviously, you might be spreading your portfolio over a few countries, so there's no way that you could really be intimately familiar with each and every place, nor could you be there physically to handle the transactions and the tenancies and so forth. So what would you advise to, let's say, a foreign investor who's been reading your books and other resources out there and has pinpointed a particular country that they're interested in? How would they manage that sort of thing remotely?
Well, so the first thing is, if you are going to do it hands-on, you really need to take a cold, hard look at how much of your time you're willing to devote to that process. If you are going to, you know, for example, I'm sitting in Hong Kong and I own property in Japan, that requires bandwidth, mental bandwidth for me to actually do that. And you need to ask yourself, is owning property directly the best way to do it? It, in fact, might make sense, might make more sense for you to own a REIT like I've done in China, because that's something that's it's divisible and it's liquid. I could sell, you know, 10 of the shares in that. I could sell my whole holding. I can increase my holding, whereas obviously you can't do that with an apartment. And there are other ways that you can go about that as well. You could buy shares in developers. You could buy emerging market debt, for example. There's lots of ways you can do it. You don't physically have to own the property to do it. If you are going to go down that route, you know, make sure that you know what you're getting yourself in for. So I would say, you know, go get some dirt on your shoes, walk around, learn as much as you possibly can about the country, about the city, right down to the neighborhood, because the more you know, the better placed you're going to be. And the research part of it is really hard to overstate, simply because people get an idea in their head and they're going to buy. And if they haven't actually done the research, they don't really know how good a deal they're getting. And using the example again of the shows that come here to Hong Kong, I've seen Japanese properties sold here, you know, in some of these shows that basically it was junk. It was stuff that had been picked over in Japan. I don't think anybody in Japan would have bought it. Yield wasn't great. Location wasn't great. But here in Hong Kong, everything is so expensive that it actually looked like a good deal. So going and doing that research is it's hard to overstate just how important that is. The next thing, though, is relationships. If you were, you know, you think about this for a minute. If you're operating across international borders and you're operating in a language that you don't understand, you are utterly dependent on your partners. And that means the agent who you're buying through, but it also means the agent who's managing the property. And also, you know, if you're speaking about Japan, you're reliant on that agent to make sure that the tenants that you get in there are good. And one of the great things about Japan, in the 10 years that I own property there, Japanese tenants are wonderful. I mean, my experience has been uniformly positive. They pay the rent on time. They ask for very, very little. They don't move often. And you really can't say that about a lot of countries. Hmm. Having said that, though, there are certainly cases in Japan where tenants know what their rights are and basically go out of their way to game the system. And I've heard horror stories about how that has really made life very difficult for some landlords. So the quality of the relationships and the partners that you use, it's really, really hard to overstate that as well.
Absolutely. We definitely find the same. To be honest, we've had, I'm sorry to say this being a non-Japanese myself, but we've had a lot more tenancy issues with non-Japanese than we've had with Japanese. Like you say, the Japanese themselves are generally excellent tenants.
Yes.
Okay, so location-wise in Japan, from your experience, which spots are looking attractive to you at this point in time?
Well, the short answer is going to be Tokyo. If you look at the demographic trends, you have lots and lots of people moving into Tokyo, and it's multi-generational, so retirees move to Tokyo because there are hospitals there so they can get medical care. They also move there for the restaurants and the museums and the cultural aspects of things. Young people move to Tokyo for jobs. So while Japan's population, Tokyo and to a lesser degree Osaka and Nagoya are benefiting from inward migration from, you know, secondary and tertiary cities. So those are the easiest places to look. And also, if you're a foreign buyer, those three cities are the ones that are easiest to understand, the most international. If you go outside of that, things become a little bit more complicated, and the research and the general process becomes a little bit more complicated. I think Fukuoka is an absolutely lovely city, and I'd love to live there. I've been scuba diving in Okinawa, and I would absolutely love to own a place there. But if you're buying something like an apartment in Tokyo or a series of apartments in Tokyo, you have to or in Japan, you have to think about buying them, but at the same time, you also have to think about selling them. And it's going to be much easier to sell an apartment or a piece of retail property in a major metropolis than it is somewhere outside. Japan's secondary and tertiary cities are in huge trouble. Population decline, shrinking tax bases, and from that, the next problem that you end up with is infrastructure that's crumbling, and because there's no tax base, there's no business there, there's no money to repair the bridges and the roads and to provide, in some cases, basic services like trash collection and snow shoveling and things like that. That's not in every city, but it's a recurring theme, and if you look at the numbers, a lot of the secondary and tertiary cities and towns are being amalgamated, and basically the population is, you know, old and dying off, and the young people are moving to big cities. So a lot of foreigners that I know go to the countryside and they think, wow, this is really beautiful and I'd love to buy a place. But again, how do you sell it when it's all said and done? That really becomes, you know, a major issue. Now, one sort of bright spot in all of this, potentially, though, if you have a long view, is with everything that's gone on with COVID-19, we're seeing countries around the world focusing on a thing called autarky, which is a fancy way of saying being self-sufficient. And that goes to everything from things like surgical masks to pharmaceuticals to all kinds of different manufacturing, agriculture, a variety of other things. And I think what you may see going forward in places like Japan is that you may see some of the manufacturing that was offshored to China, to Thailand, to Vietnam, to Indonesia, places like that, may start to move back to Japan. And that could give some of these secondary and tertiary cities a little boost. But that's a far more speculative buy than buying, you know, a small apartment in the core of one of the major cities.
I have to say, I definitely agree with you on the countryside properties and the smaller townships that are in population decline. But metropolitan-wise, man, Tokyo and Osaka yields are horrible. They're pretty much where they've been. I mean, we've seen a good decline in the last 2 months with the outbreak. But generally speaking, they're at the level they were pre-1990, the bubble burst.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, Tokyo and Osaka prices, again, aside from the last 2 months or so, yields have been compressed unbelievably. I mean, we're not seeing anything beyond 3 or 4% there. And other places, like you've mentioned, Nagoya and Fukuoka, or even maybe the satellite cities around Tokyo and Osaka, where they're, you know, within 45 or 1 hour train ride to the city, they still enjoy population growth. And the yields are just nothing to compare.
Interesting. It also depends, too, on what you're buying. There is, among Asian buyers, there is a general bias towards buying new property. And then the depreciation you get hit with when you buy something new, it can be quite horrific. Whereas if you buy something that's, you know, built in the 80s after the last round of seismic regulation upgrades, so you know it's fairly solidly built, it's small, it's near a train station, sometimes you can get a much better yield out of that than you can out of buying something that as a foreigner you might like to buy to live in, I should say.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's mostly the profile that most of the people that we work with go through. Okay, good stuff, thank you for that. I think listeners would definitely benefit from this point of view and experience there. And just before we let you go, what are you up to these days? Has this outbreak, this epidemic affected you, your business, your investment, property purchase plans?
Well, so it's been interesting here in Hong Kong. So I lived here during the SARS outbreak in 2002, 2003. And so for me and my family, this is not quite as terrifying as it is, I think, for people in, say, North America and places like that. It has caused a bit of a slowdown in business, but, you know, things chug along, and you know, we're here for the long term. I'm also in the process now of writing a seventh book. Mm-hmm. About buying real estate in the post-COVID environment. Because as I've suggested in a couple of points, there are going to be some major changes, and I think that there are going to be some major opportunities for investors who are willing to take a long view and who've got access to funding and who understand, you know, how the world works. So that's what I'm not doing, client work. I'm in the midst of writing book number seven.
Oh, that's brilliant. That should actually be a very good read, I think. And are you actually waiting for things to be a bit more smooth, or are you going to release it even if it's still going on?
Well, it will go out as soon as it's done. So that I'm hoping, or definitely going to be out before the end of the year. But you know, it's one of those, you know, harking back to something I said a little bit earlier. It's the lesson here is do your research. You know, if you're thinking about buying in a neighborhood and you understand the rhythms of the neighborhood, you understand what drives the drives buyers in the neighborhood, you understand the psychology of the place, all of the research that you do that way is going to stand you in good stead. And then that way, if you do see an opportunity, you can push the button and take advantage of it rather than going in sort of half blind. So it's really all about research. And we're, you know, the thing about COVID is the world is really changing in so many different ways, whether it be Airbnb, you know, going, morphing into whatever it becomes next. I was reading, you know, on a side note, I was reading a piece in the Vancouver newspapers a couple of days ago. The city of Vancouver has actually said that they might go into bankruptcy because they're afraid people aren't going to be able to pay their property taxes.
Oh, wow.
So there's lots and lots of moving parts here. And, of course, whenever there is great change like that, there's always great opportunities as well if you're prepared for them.
Absolutely. That's great. So we'll probably end on this note. And we're going to link to the landedbook.com to Chris's series of books in this episode show notes, folks. So go down there and just check on Chris's progress with the new book, but definitely download and purchase the older books as well if you can. You'll definitely find a great benefit in there. Well, Chris, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
My pleasure, Ziv. And also, when your readers hit landedbook.com, there's a whole bunch of videos and other free resources on there that are worth a look too, especially if you're thinking about buying.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that.
All right. There you have it. Mr. Christopher Dillon of Dillon Communications, author of the Landed series of guidebooks to global real estate, and more specifically, author of Landed Japan, now in its second revised edition again. We'll link to the book's website in this episode show notes, of course, so feel free to have a browse and, of course, purchase any or all of them. You definitely won't regret it. And in case you're interested more specifically in Japan real estate property investment, we'll also link to our own ebook series again in the show notes. Those are free to download and read, so feel free to do so. And of course, feel free to use those links to also contact Christopher or myself here at NTI with any questions, requests for more information that you might have. We always love talking shop, so don't be shy. That's it from us for today, folks. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and our conversation with Christopher Dillon. Do leave us a comment or note wherever you might have found the podcast. We're always interested in your thoughts, and we would love to hear from you. And we would, of course, hugely appreciate it if you could leave us a star rating. It only takes a few seconds, or a review, a few words, maybe a minute or two, even better, on the iTunes Store, Spotify, or wherever good podcasts can be found, downloaded, streamed, rated, and reviewed. We hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, from all of us here at NTI and at Dillon Communications, we wish you a great and safe day or night, wherever in the world you might be, and whenever you might be listening to this recording. Speak to you again soon, and until then, yoroshiku.